Hello and welcome to Blogosphere's Serious Influence, the podcast all about the business side of the influencer industry. I'm Alice Audley and I'm the founder of Blogosphere, which hopefully you've heard of, but if not, Blogosphere is a media company rooted in the world of influencers. We run events, an influencer network, and publish a nationally distributed print magazine. And now podcast two, which I'll be presenting. If there are any questions about the influencer industry that you want answered, make sure to tweet us your suggestions. Our Twitter handle is @blogosphereM. Now, on to our first guest. Today on Blogosphere's Serious Influence, I'm joined by Joshua Barnett. Josh is the managing director at After Party Studios, which is a content production company run by influencers. Before that, he was head of content partnerships at James Grant and signed off some of the business's biggest influencer deals. But before all that, he started off at ITV.
I started at ITV as a TV sales assistant, helping to manage the portfolio of brands and advertisers that spent advertising money on ITV TV. So that was interesting. But then, you know, I sort of wanted to carve my own path. So I moved from TV advertising at ITV to ITV.com. I fell into the world of digital. So 2010, I switched to ITV.com, helping to sell pre-roll advertising against ITV.com content, VOD. And I saw digital was about to boom big time. And I looked around the market and I got approached for a role from a company called My Video Rights, which was a company trying to kind of police content online, mainly through YouTube. And they were looking to take premium content rights holders onto the YouTube platform. And YouTube back then was still kind of in its infancy, really. You know, it was still quite user-generated content. I just saw these guys had a real niche. You could see how it was going to succeed. So I jumped at it. I came in there as one of their first main sales guys to sell pre-roll advertising against YouTube content.
Right.
But premium content.
What would that consist of?
So in the beginning, they worked with production companies, record labels and sports federations to take clipped content onto official channels on YouTube because no one was really doing it. Production companies, you know, might have had 5 or 6 seasons of The F Word sitting on a shelf collecting dust. And the guys saw the angle to clip the content, manage it in official channel, sell pre-roll advertising and sponsorships around the channels. And we had raging success. We picked up a lot of content rights, started working with a lot of brands and agencies to advertise. We were probably selling pre-roll on YouTube better than YouTube at that time, to be honest.
And what sort of prices were you commanding?
God, they were in the good days of, you know, talking about probably £25 to £30 CPMs, you know, cost per 1,000 ads sold, because you couldn't buy the content anywhere else at that time. And then, you know, quite quickly, the company fell into working with YouTube original channels as we now know them. I tell people quite often that, you know, the guys saw a young kid filming rappers on his estate in Acton with a shaky cam and, you know, asked if he'd like to join the network. And that was, you know, Jamal Edwards and SBTV. You know, they worked with them quite early on, not saying that we were a fundamental reason why that platform and that channel succeeded, but we were there in the early days and we helped where we could, helped to monetize, built up quite a close bond with the likes of SBTV and then a load of other YouTube original channels that followed. You know, a lot of the gaming talent, a lot of the guy and girl, you know, vloggers and original musicians to the platform. And we kind of stumbled into it.
So how did that exactly work? You're selling the pre-roll advertising, but did they have the ownership of their own channels or was this sort of a talent management company as well?
We were an original MCN. Probably one of the biggest MCNs of the time.
To explain an MCN as well, if people are listening.
Sorry, yeah. So an MCN is a dirty word these days, it feels, but it was, you know, a multi-channel network. So someone that manages a vast amount of channels on the YouTube platform, offering guidance in and around the channel best practices, looping in brand deals. So not quite the full suite of talent management, but certainly helping people grow and build their channels and helping to monetize.
And today, how many kind of MCNs do we have? Maker was bought by Disney, wasn't it?
Yeah.
For $1 billion?
$1 billion. I don't know if they ever reached getting paid out $1 billion, but it was a lot of money. There's not many. You know, you've got the people like Studio 71 that still act as an MCN and Style Hall. Brave Bison kind of is still a bit of an MCN, but have moved away from it. So Brave Bison is now what My Video Rights was. You know, My Video Rights changed name from My Video Rights to Bay 79. We got acquired by Rights to back in 2014, and that's now changed name to Brave Bison. So there's not many, and people move away from it because there just isn't much of a need for those type of companies anymore.
But back in the day, there was the need for that. So you'd have lots of channels, you'd be selling the pre-roll, and then what would the margin be? Then you split that between the creator and the company?
I wasn't too close to what the deals looked like for signing up talent back then.
Okay, because Sirius Influence is going to be getting to the nitty-gritty of these deals.
But no, I believe we were pretty fair. We genuinely sold premium. So this is the sell, right? Sign into our network and we will sell premium advertising directly onto your content rather than just being part of the mix on YouTube.
So what sort of brands were you advertising against your creators that you were representing?
We worked with all the brands, every brand you could think of, from like Sainsbury's to Puma to KFC to McDonald's. You know, we were offering these guys genuinely premium content, original content to advertise against. And obviously, as we now know, keep in mind, this is almost 10 years plus ago. You know, it was them tapping into an audience they just couldn't reach anywhere else. We now know, as I'm sure we'll probably come on to, those audiences are even greater now than they were then. So it was genuinely a great place to buy a specific audience on original content on the platform.
And then how did pre-roll sort of mature in the relationships that you had when you were at Base 79 My Video Rights with influencers? So for instance, you have the pre-roll, but then do you do bespoke brand deals? When did that sort of start developing?
We sold pre-roll advertising against the content. Then we got asked about, can we reskin the channels? So back then YouTube had really nice channel skin, which is very different now. It looks a lot more editorial. So we got asked the question, can we reskin the channels?
What does that mean?
Literally a brand coming on and having, you know, just everyone would have their specific artwork surrounding the YouTube channel. So then people would say, oh, can I do a takeover? I've got a film coming out. You know, Ill Manners is coming out with Plan B's film. Can we do a reskin for the week of release where we're just driving people to go and see that film?
So, for instance, Drake doing that on Spotify recently is the same sort of thing?
Same sort of vibe. You know, we did it on the YouTube platform back way when. And then I was the first person to, you know, host a live stream from multiple YouTuber channels. So Red Bull had, they were doing something at an event called Gridsters. They were streaming this sort of gaming competition with Vettel and Weber at the time, playing against these kind of, you know, driving gamers. And they needed to find an audience. I think, you know, on their own website, they were only generating a few thousand hits on the live stream. So we concocted a plan to host the live stream on five key gaming channels across this two-day event, and then obviously getting the talent to drive people to kind of watch this gaming event. I mean, there was like a couple of hundred thousand concurrent views, you know, millions of catch-up views. So it was a really big successful campaign, and we kind of stumbled our way into that stuff. You know, even branded content. I remember Rizzle Kicks made a music video for the PlayStation Vita that came out like years ago. They said, oh, can we host it as an exclusive on SBTV's channel? And again, it was like, I don't know, let's ask the question. Had a chat with Jamal. It was like, yeah, why not? Rizzle Kicks have been on the channel. They feel relevant. The song isn't bad. And they hosted it as an exclusive on the channel. And then we fell into, you know, branded content as we kind of now know it. Can we actually work with the guys, make some content that sort of loops in the brand?
Did everything have to be editorially signed off with the influencer and their channel as well? So with Rizzle Kicks, you went and spoke to Jamal and then he said it's okay. So you didn't have the rights to say, look, this brand wants to and we're going to place it on your channel.
No, it was everything we did was hand in hand. You know, we could help sell advertising against the channel, but in terms of the running of the channel, the content, you know, that was completely still in the ownership of all of the content owners and channel owners.
Did you find at that time, what was kind of brands' thought process on influencers, because it must have been so new back then, and still today I think we have a lot of problems with brands understanding the value of influencers. I mean, you were selling, so what was your sales pitch back then?
Give us some money and we'll make some great stuff. The sad thing is it almost feels as difficult now as it was back then, because then you had a few brands that, like, I guess some challenger brands that like not necessarily didn't have anything to lose, but with that Mattison's example, it's like, you know what, we're not getting the cut through we want. Let's try and change it up and let's do something different. And I think there was still a lot of hand-holding back then. It still feels the same level now, but we were targeting very relevant brands that wanted to play like in that space, you know? And I think because we were one of the kind of original companies in the space, there was only a few of us back then. Do you know what I mean? It was us, Channel Flip, you know, the big American companies weren't here yet, the Makers and the Studio 71s and stuff. You know, we were the go-to place. I mean, once we started to get established, people coming to us to brief us in, and we were converting quite a lot of business. It was really exciting, you know. We did a big campaign with the Home Office. And I guess, you know, the Home Office just weren't ready to relinquish control, any control, to working with influencers at that time. That was a pickle. You know, we sort of had meeting upon meeting and we're in the Home Office a lot and with the head of marketing for Home Office, and they didn't get that it wasn't just an advert they paid for where they could just turn up and sort of direct and, you know, tell people to read a script. And
I think this is a problem that we're still having today, but you are at Base 79 and until it's acquired?
So Base 79 got acquired back in 2014 by Rightstar. I then stayed on till kind of 2016. You know, there was a bit of an earn out for the company. A lot of us more senior people wanted to stay there and steady the ship, as it were, and didn't want to see the company sort of fall off a cliff. So we stayed and kept driving the business forward. Again, we'd built the team. I think our sales team then was probably up to almost 8 to 10 people. And we were doing some great stuff in the market. And then I kind of got to the level of UK sales director there, managing a great team. And I almost felt like I'd done everything I could. They were about to change direction slightly and change into Brave Bison. I thought that was a good time for me to tap out.
And that's when you went to
James Grant. Yeah, so James Grant, probably the most established talent agent in, or talent management company, I should say, in the UK. They approached me a couple of times. And on the second time, I didn't know whether to kind of go. I was still doing media sales as well as the branded content and influencer stuff. So I was at a junction where I didn't know whether to keep down the media sales route or stick with talent and content and influencers. But the James Grant opportunity was too good to turn down, really.
And so what was that role?
So I stepped into a head of content partnerships role as part of the brand team at James Grant. So, you know, James Grant is made up of obviously a lot of talent, loads of talent agents, but then also there's a number of services they provide to all the talent. As you can imagine, one of those services and the biggest service is probably the commercial arm, which help to manage all the inbound briefs that come in from the market into the talent, and then also proactively help to sell talent into different brands and verticals that they're interested in.
Had they launched a social talent division at that time, or did that kind of cross over with you? Because they have kind of traditional talent,
yeah,
and then influencers. When did they sort of first start signing influencers?
They already had a social division, head up by a lovely lass called Sophie Gildersleeve. And with James Grant, I guess it's quality over quantity. And because they're steeped in heritage, been going almost 30 years, you know, for them, they've really got to see something in a social talent to help them build and grow into something off of platforms like YouTube. So I think they've been quite selective. I think they came probably late to the game, you know, on the social front, if they're being honest. They came late to the game. They've never really got it right. They've never cracked it.
Do they still have a social division now?
So now they look at TV and social sort of merged as one, just under the entertainment umbrella.
And what are your views on that? Because I think, I mean, at Blogosphere, we distinguish influencers being social media first. So we kind of wouldn't interview someone that was a reality TV star that then has a big social following. They have to have built their kind of empires organically through social media. And do you think there's a difference in those audiences? And is that something that you find difficult to be able to articulate to brands? That's
wow,
a long question.
I like that. Listen, I do think that the tides are turning, even for more traditional talent. So even when I first went in there to when I left there, traditional talent from when I first went in, like, wouldn't even consider really doing like an Instagram only something, you know. But then by the time I left, that was definitely an option. I do think both those worlds are merging. The reason why I joined James Grant is because you could see the worlds of social talent and traditional talent kind of blurring slightly. Like, I do think there is still a distinction from like a social native or, you know, a digital original talent versus a traditional. But I think both sides have got to kind of learn from each other in a way.
And do you think recently there seems to have been a mass exodus of talent from talent agencies that are sort of bringing it in-house? Why do you think that is? Do you think that talent management have been getting it wrong? And how are they going to fix it and make themselves have a place in this market moving forward?
Some of the ones that have broken away on the digital specific front, I think, have been at their respective agencies for some time. And I think you get to the point when you've been on a platform like YouTube for 8 to 10 years for some of these guys and girls, you probably strive for different things, you know? And I think some of them have probably been there, seen it and done it with their talent agencies, probably thank them for doing a great job, but they want to push on in different directions, you know? Maybe they want to start nurturing their own talent coming through that they can't do under their respective talent agents. So I think there's a bit of that. I also do think that, you know, especially on some of the newer digital-first talent agents, I do question just how much they're doing for the talent, how much guidance they're giving them, you know, in their careers, and how many doors they can truly open.
Because that's the value add, really, isn't it? It's, I think back in the day, maybe it was more contracts and kind of pushing back on figures, but now you could just hire someone in-house when you are successful in terms of being able to afford someone else's salary, that maybe that makes more sense, or at least that's kind of what we're seeing, so that they have more control over exactly what deals are coming to them. They can say yes or no for everything, because sometimes it sounds like not all of the deals get presented to the talent. Additionally, I think a lot of people haven't had the feedback from the brand, so that there are these kind of intermediaries that are blocking some conversations on both sides, and the influencers want to have the feedback from the brands to know what's been successful.
I completely agree. I mean, I do think, you know, we're in the world of, you know, fragmentation, saturation. You know, I think Gleam, when they had some of the big guns a couple of years ago, maybe there was like 15 on the roster. Now Gleam probably has 40. They're global. So I think, you know, some of these guys and girls want to take their destiny in their own hands a little bit. Hire someone that can go and knock on some doors, that has some really good contacts into brands, that can be a bit more specific, you know, take back ownership of their inbox. Because having worked with talent for a few years now, there is no better lead generator than the inbox of some of these guys and girls, because there's brands or agencies actively in the market looking to want to work with them. So taking back a bit of that control. And I also think planning for the future, you know, some of the older guard of YouTube, I think they do see, like, I'm heading towards 30. I mean, that's not old, but like, I've been doing this a while, heading towards 30. What do I do next? So I think there's a, you know, a mixture of all those things.
Could you give an overview of a campaign from start to finish with an influencer and how that would work?
So we did a campaign for Ollie White and Hasbro. We were speaking to, I think it came into, you know, the inbox of Ollie, right? Hasbro from America, wanting to work with you. We're pushing some of the traditional board games back out to the market. Seeing what you do with your brother James and love it. Can we work together? So then that would come through to me and my team. We would then, you know, jump on a call, flesh out a bit of the brief, what they're looking to do, and then, you know, go away, work up some ideas with Ollie that could loop in his brother or not, and then go back with, you know, a bit of a treatment written about the idea. Then you get into kind of some of the nuts and bolts of the pricing, how much it is for a video on his channel, how much it is, you know, for some social support, for some social cutdowns. You know, you get into the world of usage, if they want to use the content outside of his channel into little kind of short form clips or little pre-roll adverts. And then you kind of go through, you know, an approval process on the treatment. Then you kind of have a timeline in place of when he's going to film it, when you then go through the rounds of approval for the video, normally one, max two rounds of approval on the videos, and then you kind of look to set live dates to put the content live and have him support socially, if that makes that, sense. That's in a snapshot.
No, I like it. I think that was very coherent. Not speaking about Ollie, but what sort of, for a campaign that has YouTube, and you've mentioned the social support elements, what sort of prices are we seeing in the market back then and today?
The money's not what it once was, especially around some of the bigger talent, because you've got this world of, you know, mid-tier to micro-influencer. So I think the money is being spread a lot thinner and a lot wider now.
But were we seeing?
So I think you're looking at, you know, anything from 20 to 25 grand a YouTube video with some social support for kind of that level of talent. I'd say maybe you're looking at, you know, the sort of 2 million plus, I would say 2025. I guess when you get into some of the more big guns, then, you know, depending if they're willing to get out of bed for the money, you know, they're probably, I guess now 50, would have been 50K plus.
And then now that's being spread thinner because brands are wanting to, would you say, have a more strategic approach on multi-tier influencers?
I guess so. You know, I've just come out of a very good meeting with a friend of mine at StoryLab, and we were talking about it. You know, it's almost, it feels like the middle ground of sort of influencers is kind of losing out, because people are either going to go and do something quite big with a bigger talent, or just go with one of the micro sort of, you know, the influencer marketing platforms and plug in some cash, work with 5 or 20 influencers at a certain level. So it feels like the middle ground of influencers social are taking a bit of a hit at the moment, I'd say.
Do you think that with micro-influencers, it's being seen more as a media buy, a straight media buy with these platforms. And what do you see their role is currently and their future?
100% media buy. I mean, it is, you know, and I do say, like, I'm on the fence with some of the micro platforms, but I do say to anyone that will listen, if a brand is still plugging money into display advertising, stop it and put it into a micro platform, because you will get a million times more engagement. You'll shift a load more product. Like, that's, you know, I don't need many stats to back that up. That's just, you know, that's just clear for everyone to see. I would have thought, for me, there's only so far those platforms can go, because, you know, you plug in, you put a product in someone's hand, they take a flat lay pick and then get some likes and, you know, hearts and stuff. Great. Anything above that is then into the kind of platforms acting as a influencer marketing agency, where they then broker the deals, handhold, have to speak to the talent to come up with ideas to then report back.
And some of those commissions that are being taken, what do they kind of range from? I mean, I've heard anything from 15% to sort of 50%.
That's the thing, man. We're in this world of, you know, people, I'm definitely not going to use the word WW in this interview, because it's been banded around far too much. But
it's the Wild West.
Yeah. Glad I didn't have to say it. So, you know, it has become a bit like that. And it has become the world of people, you know, middleman, making their markups, you know, the true cost not quite finding its way back to the talent in quite a lot of instances.
Do you think this industry as a whole currently is a bit of a mess? And that's not to be really negative, because I think when you say something's a mess, there's opportunity to fix it, but that everybody has heard this buzzword. I mean, I was kind of saying to you earlier that I feel that we're in now the second generation of influencers. You've got the first ones, the kind of 2009 era, that are now coming to towards 30 and maybe changing direction, who did start it purely as a hobby and they had no idea it would be a career. But now you've got the second wave, who have seen all of the first wave grow up and have come in with a different kind of attitude. But we're in first generation with the sort of mass influencer marketing, everybody kind of getting behind it, and people are just grabbing, you know, commissions are changing, and there is no sort of industry body or authority. Is that something that you feel that we need?
I think so. I think, you know, it is a bit of a mess. But like you said, that's not a negative. You know, anything that is as new and as fresh and as exciting with so much money going into it is going to be like that. I mean, crypto is exactly the same. Crypto and blockchain, you know, it's like the buzz thing. Everyone's throwing money at it. Don't know why. Is it going to be successful? Not sure. But I just need a bit of it.
Sorry, I was just going to say, I feel like with influencer marketing, people know it's working, and that's why people are increasing their budgets into it. They know it's working, but they don't know really why, what those metrics are, what that return of investment is. Do you think this is the biggest thing that brands are wanting to know now? Because they know that, you know, you've got percentage increase in sales, but it can't be necessarily tracked towards influencers at the stage. So really it's part of the pie, an extra part of the pie that they can't allocate to anything else. It must be influencers.
I think there's a lot of companies now trying to kind of smarten up on the reporting side and working back to kind of ROI, because it is important. But I do think with the money that's going in to it, you know, there has been a lot of proof in the pudding. You know, when you look at, I think it was 2016, there was like a few percent of people's marketing spend going towards kind of influencers. 2017 was, you know, about 10 to 15% for some. This year is going to be, you know, 25% plus for a lot of marketeers spending money into influencer space. So it is working. For me, if there was anything I would invest money in right now, it would be that trackable, traceable, you know, working back to, you know, just how many sales have been generated or what the uplift is from a brand perception, all that kind of stuff.
And I know there's brand sentiment, which is one of the measurables that people are feeding back into this return of investment at the moment, which is interesting. Earlier, when we were talking about the micro-influencer platforms and the middle layer of influencer missing out, at the top level, I feel that what we're seeing is much more kind of ambassadorships and direct relationships. Do you see this happening as well? And I mean, I think it's a great thing to be able to work on an annual campaign with an influencer. Are we seeing less of this one-off product placement and more creative campaigns? And I suppose that leads into also where you're working now at After Party. So yeah, Maybe a bit about that.
It's good, you know, you're well placed to help answer some of these questions that we're talking about. So that's not a bad thing.
Subscribe to Blogosphere magazine. Plug.
Plug. I think that I long to see more brands embracing working with influencers for a longer period of time. you know, when I was at James Grant, that was definitely what we were saying. You know, let's work on more longer tail campaigns, you know, get the influencer really bought into it. You're going to get more value in the long term. So I think there needs to be a bit more of that. There is still a little bit of kind of pick me up, put me down attitude from brands, just trying to kind of get a quick bit of brand fame from doing something with someone. It's always going to leave a bit of a bitter taste in people's mouths, you know, when that kind of stuff happens. There's always a lot of promises of, oh, this is a test, you know, it will lead on to more stuff.
Yeah.
And it's almost like tomorrow never comes. And the more the brands can wrap their arms around digital talent as ambassadors for their brands, while still looking at, you know, traditional talent, like traditional media still have their place.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, it'll be a good place for us. And, you know, I left James Grant sort of back end of last year to join up with pals of mine, a YouTuber called Callum McGinley. His YouTube name's Calyx. And then one of the founders of Base79, a guy called Richard Mansell. They came together 2 years ago to set up After Party Studios, which was, you know, started out to just make some better content on Callum's channel when working with brands, deliver a higher quality of branded content. And then they kind of, you know, started to loop some of Callum's network into content, and then sort of flipped it to actually getting asked to make content for some of their friends in the network. And then I joined in January to kind of, you know, drive business forward, work on some more kind of multi-talent campaigns, not just with Callum, still working very much within his network, and then also developing new formats and, you know, investing in original content.
Are brands wanting to have original content made by influencers to promote on their own channels? Is that the biggest thing that you find that they're asking for now?
I think not as many of them are doing that as I'd probably like, to be honest. But I do think brands are looking to work with influencers more now, just not on their own channels, but off channel, you know, for their own websites and platforms.
I feel that lots of people have been missing the trick here as well, and they have this tunnel vision where it's like an influencer, we'll put the influencer on our own YouTube channel. But when you take an influencer off of the platform that they're on and put them somewhere else where they're not traditionally seen. I mean, you've seen this with kind of L'Oreal campaign, which I think they did so well. They have their beauty squad, their ambassadors, and then, you know, they're doing, say, print advertising or display advertising, but it's not just print and display, because everybody has a mobile device. So when they see those ads, they're going to be taking a picture and it's going to go straight back to Instagram on social. It's like people haven't got the full circle and realise that there's a fluidity between advertising forms.
It's all got to match up. You know, just trying to get a talent to create some content and stick it on their own channels with, you know, even just a few social posts driving towards that content, it's just never going to perform anywhere near as good as, you know, if they do kind of some stuff that's a bit more joint up.
And I was going to ask you about work with Callum. He's been pretty vocal about the adpocalypse that YouTube kind of had a couple of years ago. Was that a couple of years ago? Maybe it was last year, maybe you're better positioned to answer this, but there was a fallout, I'm not saying with Callum, but with some channels, LGBT videos were pinpointed as well. And so the advertising just got cut, and brand deals then are wary of this as well. So in terms of brand safety, is that a big problem that you're having to convince brands to work with people in the industry as a whole?
The brand safety thing, I mean, YouTube has sort of go through spits and spurts of, you know, doing really well, then taking a hammering for something. You know, you've got the PewDiePie gate of, you know, last year or year before. You've got obviously Logan Paul entertaining the world with such a stupid video. So I think there's a brand safety issue, you know, not only from my ad sales experience, you know, when you look into that world, YouTube have got into trouble with, you know, certain ads running on certain content, which is just not cool.
It's always the influencers, though, that seem to be pinpointed in the news stories, because they know that those stories are probably going to get the most hits.
It is a shame, like, you know, look, what it happens with a lot of stuff, you know, one person ruins it for all.
Well, so this must be really frustrating as well, because it does, doesn't it? It impacts everybody. I only saw a tweet this morning of a YouTuber getting into a bath full of bleach. I think Helen Anderson, who we've interviewed, another YouTuber, quotes and says, this is, you know, we spend all of our time trying to, you know, make brands take us seriously and realise the hard work that goes into this, and then you have one idiot that ruins it for the rest of us.
Yes, there is, you know, you're always going to get that. But I think, you know, YouTube and the creators on the platform always have a way of kind of rallying around and, you know, fighting back against that stuff. The ad apocalypse thing, you know, I mean, you hear the word algorithm just on a daily basis in online media and influencers right now across, you know, the likes of YouTube and Facebook. So I think you can, you know, you never know what you're going to get into on that side. But what is for sure, YouTube tightened their belt in terms of quality of content. And that obviously meant a lot of people missing out, rightly or wrongly. They weren't in that upper echelon of quality content as far as YouTube were concerned. So started to miss out. Some people spoke out quite vocally about it, including Callum.
Phil DeFranco just did it this morning. 8 of his news videos have just been demonetized.
So, you know, a lot of these guys and girls are, they've been doing it for a long time. They've helped prop up the YouTube platform. I have to say, you know, on our side, you know, we asked some questions of some good YouTube contacts and they answered and they helped us out. They did what they could.
Be good to get them on the podcast as well.
Yeah, not sure everyone could say that about YouTube contacts. I don't know. Some people don't even know who to contact at YouTube.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a bit of that going on, but we've been helped out. You've got to keep going. You know, what Callum didn't do, he came off platform for a while, rethought it, and now started to get back into the flow, creating some great content. You know, we've just launched a new show called The After Party, which dropped on Saturday, which is a 30-minute show. The guys came together and thought there's nothing like a James Corden or Jimmy Fallon style show on YouTube. So,
but also so funny how to do that, because on the trending page of YouTube, those are the only shows that are being pushed forward. You know,
yes.
It's all Ellen and Jimmy Kimmel.
Ellen, film trailers. So, you know, sort of tap into a, you know, a tempo thing happening on the platform and just create some great content. And I think it's worked really well. The reaction in the market's been good from fans and influencers alike. And I think that's what people have just got to keep doing, keep changing, investing time and effort and some money into creating great content. And that's what will prevail, I think, over time. I think authenticity is a big thing. When people kind of back up to want to work with a specific talent, they're kind of working with them because, you know, they've done their research, you like to think, and they like the look of them and the content they produce. And people should just run with that initial feeling and kind of let the talent run with it and interpret it in their own way, stay authentic to their audience. Because as soon as you start muscling in with certain brand messages and trying to take back control, then the message can just get lost on both sides, basically. And, you know, when it comes to brand safety, brands should make sure that they're looking under the microscope of who they want to work with and why. Go back, you know, a few years to their YouTube content and check it out. And it kind of works both sides, you know.
How do you see it as people spending money in future? Because it is a new form of marketing, isn't it?
God knows. If you tell me, I wish I could look into that crystal ball. What I do know is that media agencies are struggling to get their heads around it. So I think you've got a lot of these, you know, influencer marketing agencies that are winning out currently because, you know, not to be ageist at all, but they're companies that are young, plugged in individuals that kind of get it, get social, get influencers, speak the language, which is why they're winning out. You know, I think the media agencies in general are just moving way too slowly to kind of wrap their arms around this stuff and to be offering a really good service to some of their clients, in my eyes. So I think you'll see more influencer agencies kind of sprouting up. There are a few digital talent agencies that are kind of worth their salt, you know, doing a good job. Maybe people that have a more mature kind of media background that are coming into the industry, not just trying to turn a quick buck. I don't think the influencer platforms, you know, the micro platforms aren't going away.
Yeah.
I think there's only going to be more of them and probably taking more cash, developing out, you know, the one thing they do have, because mostly talent are plugged straight in to their systems. You can have like a real-time view on all of the metrics behind who's viewed the post from where, how many likes, how many comments.
Do you think that the deliverables in terms of that are going to change as well? Because I know that everybody kind of going out talking about how many subscribers somebody has, but that's not views, that's not engagement. What are the metrics that brands, do you think, should be looking for?
We're definitely beyond the views and kind of likes on a video. Definitely beyond subscribers. I mean, that was, you know, bloody hell, even last year, probably people still going, how many subscribers has he got? It's like, well, you know, he's got millions, but actually only about 10, 15% of them are actually turning up to watch content. So I definitely think, you know, views is still a great metric. You still want to be working with someone that's, you know, getting great viewing count. But then, you know, what are the comments in and around the content? You know, I think tracking, you know, if you're doing call to action stuff, tracking that stuff, too many people just don't have anything to track even where things click off to and from. You talk about sort of brand sentiment. There's some great sort of social listening tools that people should look to use to see just who's talking about their brand, you know, in and around an influencer campaign.
What do you think the biggest problems we have from an industry side are? So we have influencers on the one side, brands, agencies, PRs on the other. I think the lines of communication aren't as good as they need to be, but the conversations that are happening within the industry, what do you think are the biggest problems there?
I think we're kind of back to almost the ageism point of like how you've got this old traditional world and this new world, and they're not merging that well at the moment still. And I do think it needs more people to embrace the change that's coming, embrace influencers. You know, I love what Blogosphere do because you guys bring a sense of sensibility to the influencer market and make it feel a bit more mature and give it, you know, just a really good tone of voice. I think we need more people doing that.
And then finally, I'd like to ask you about influencer events and what gaps do you think that there are in the market at the moment?
You know, there's quite a few good little niche events that go on. You know, Eventbrite is quite a good place to check out sort of some little pockets of stuff that happen. Some of the bigger events are Fandem. I went to the launch of VidCon Europe last year in Amsterdam. And, you know, there's a panel of four people chewing the fat, you know, YouTubers talking about their story of how they started out. And that's on the industry day.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I don't ever really seem to learn anything different at these sorts of things. You know, even when I went to the Festival of Marketing for the last couple of years from last year, you know, last year, year before, it was actually quite scary, like the influencer sessions and what marketeers were hearing from people. Because I was like, this is like 5 years ago. Are you joking? YouTube Brandcast, if you've ever been to one of those.
I did actually. I went in 2014. Yeah. I was with Zoella. She was the keynote speaker. So we did a day together.
Love that.
Yeah.
Brandcast from YouTube is their kind of yearly upfronts, right? Telling you everything there is to know about the platform, what's coming up. And I do think I always come away from that being entertained, educated, not just from YouTube, but big partners of the platform. And I just feel like I learn something and I enjoy my time. So I think there's almost something in that kind of format where you have, you know, some keynote speakers, some great people on the platform and from YouTube talking, obviously influencers, you know, taking part and having involvement. So I think something like that, you know, I think Hello World and VidCon are gearing up to more, the Summer in the Cities are gearing up to more the fan stuff and meet and greets and the bubblegum side. But
yeah, well, maybe Blogosphere Serious Influence can move into the events space as well.
Let's do it. You guys are in a great position to help lead the charge.
So thanks very much, Josh, for joining us on Blogosphere Serious Influence. I think you have given a very interesting insight into the influencer world, and I look forward to catching up at Blogosphere Serious Influence, the event.
Sounds good to me. Thank you very much for having me, and yeah, wish you guys all the best. Thank you.
A big thank you to Josh for coming on the show. You've been listening to Blogosphere Serious Influence with me, Alice Audley. Be sure to check out blogosphere magazine.com for influencer industry updates. And why not treat yourself to a magazine subscription whilst you're there?